Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhara Shrista Gaurabhakta Vrinda. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So, we'll try to cover the first part of the Bhakti Rasa Amrita Sindhu Nectar devotion. There are four parts to the whole book. It's called the ocean of Bhakti Rasa and or Sindhu, and the ocean is divided into four parts: east, south, west, and north. So the four major parts of the book. The first part of the book deals with the different types of bhakti. The second part explains what is rasa. Third part explains in detail the primary rasas, five primary rasas. And the last part explains the seven secondary rasas. So we will only cover the first part of the book. First part of the book has four waves in it, or four parts, subparts to it. Since it's an ocean, in the eastern ocean, eastern part of the ocean, there are four waves. And the first wave deals with general description of bhakti, or samanya bhakti. The second part deals with sadhana bhakti, which has two parts, Vaidhi Bhakti and Raghunuga Bhakti. The third part deals with Bhav Bhakti, and the fourth part deals with Prem Bhakti. Especially this first part of the Nectar Devotion depends upon definitions. Definitions of bhakti, definitions of sadhana bhakti, definitions of vaidhi bhakti, definition of raganuga bhakti, bhava bhakti, and prem bhakti. So we will study those definitions in some detail. So to begin with, as is normal in classical Sanskrit works, the work begins with glorification of Krishna, and particularly this book, because it is about Krishna, though it is about Bhakti Rasa Amrita Sindhu, or the nectar of devotion, or the ocean of Bhakti Rasa. The main person in this rasa is Krishna, so there's a glorification of Krishna to begin with. And that is represented in this first verse. Vidur, Jayati, which are the last words there. Of course, Vidur refers to Vishnu or Krishna. Vidu, that's one meaning of the word. The other meaning of the word is a moon. So there's two meanings to the verse. One in terms of the moon and one in terms of Vishnu. So take Krishna. So Vidu, of course, means Krishna. So Krishna Jayati means all glories to Krishna, or describes Krishna as being all attractive. Krishna stands all attractive, gloriously, with all of his attractive features. So the rest of the verse explains how he is attractive. So the first phrase is Akila Rasamrita Murti, which probably everyone can understand. And that means he is the form of all, he's a sweet form of all rasas. Or he's the sweetness of all rasas incarnate. Akila Rasa, of course, means all rasas Rasa means taste. And that's the literal meaning, taste. When we eat something, we get a taste. Or when you see something, you get an experience, either pleasurable or unpleasurable. Yeah? So it's the, in this positive aspect, it is the enjoyment we get from our senses contacting something. And in the higher sense of the term, it means a relationship, the experience we have of enjoyment we get from a relationship with another person. So we're familiar with the material rasas in this material world. Our actions are dependent upon the quest for rasa or pleasure through relationships. Of course, some people have relationships with inanimate objects like cars and televisions, I suppose. But the more pleasurable relationships are relationships with people. So in the material world, we have this perverted reflection of rasa. But that is all we're familiar with, so it's, we can just relate with that. So there's some pleasure derived from that relationship. Or should be, or we're seeking pleasure through that relationship. And there's different types of relationships, all with their particular types of pleasure. So, of course, in the spiritual world, we have the five primary rasas. That is Shanta rasa, Dasya rasa, Sakya rasa, Vatsalya rasa, and Madhurya or Shringa rasa. These are five primary rasas. And they're also there in the material world. And we establish relationships with people, and they'll be of these different forms. And then there is the secondary rasas that we have, such as humor, fear, pity, or like that, ghastliness, chivalry, and bravery, etc. So we have seven secondary rasas also. They are the pure form in the spiritual world, but they're secondary to the main. The main rasas are relationships of love, and the secondary ones have a little bit, let's say, negative qualities to them, in one sense, slightly negative qualities to them sometimes, and they enhance the main rasas. These are also in the material world. In fact, Bhaktivinoda Thakur says in the material world, it's opposite. The secondary rasas become primary. And the primary rasas become secondary. So the secondary ones become more popular with everyone. So therefore, generally, people are attracted to violence. You turn on the television, you go to the movies, all violence. This is vibhatsa rasa. Fear. They frighten you. Horror movies and things like this. Or you have comedies. So these types of rasas become quite prominent in the material world. The secondary rasas. Of course, there's also the combination with the primary rasas also. So usually there's a love story somewhere in the horror movie or whatever, the science fiction movie or the epic or the fighting movie, which is very rasa, and then you'll find some love story mixed up in that also, of some sort. And so there's a mixture there, but quite prominent in the material world of the secondary rasas. They become very prominent. So the rasas are there. And, of course, in the material, the problem with the rasas is that we put ourselves in the center, as a center of enjoyment. And in the spiritual world, Krishna is the center. And he is the natural center, so therefore this phrase expresses that he is the very form of all rasas. He is the origin of all rasas, and he's the center of all rasas. All possible types of relationships are centered upon Krishna. And it's through Krishna that we will get a true experience of that rasa. Whatever rasa we desire. Yeah. And of course, the title of this book is Bhakti Rasa Amrita Sindhu, the ocean of nectar of rasa, of bhakti. So the center of that, where does the ocean come from of bhakti rasa? Krishna is the cause of it all. He is the source of this ocean of rasa. So therefore the first phrase is representing Krishna as rasa. Then after that, prasrama ruchi rudra taraka pali. Taraka and Pali are two gopis. And with the various means that he controls, brings under control the gopis like Tara and Pali by his ruchi, which emanating ruchi, his emanating beauty or his effulgence. He's able to bring under control the different gopis. Huh? And Kalita Shama Lalita, Lalito, he is embraced by Shama and Lalita. These are more gopis. He's the dearmost of Radha. Radha gives her very life to Krishna. So this describes a progression of different shades of attraction to Krishna among the gopis. Of course, the Madhurya Rasa. So those who are more distant, those who are closer, and those most close to Krishna. Of course, in the Radha is the dearmost of Krishna also. And we have different groups of gopis, those who are closest to Krishna, closest to Krishna is Radha, and then around Radha there are her own associates, or her swapaksha, like Vishakha and Lalita, etc. And then outside that we have other gopis who are friendly, called supaksha gopis, and a little more distant. And then more distant is the neutral gopis, and paksha. And then on the other side we got the anti-gopis, the like Chandravali and her group, the vipaksha, the opposite party. That's also expressed as this Tara, Pali, Shama, Lalita, and then Radha. Like different shades of gopis in comparison to Radha, and the different intensities of their love. So in this way we have a description of Krishna as the center of rasa, and then we have a description of the different gopis and Madhurya Rasa who are related to Krishna with different intensities of love for Krishna, of rasa. So that's one meaning of the verse. The other meaning of the verse, of course, is that there's a moon. Vidu is a moon. So the moon is also very attractive, shining. And the moon is also known as the source of amrita, a source of nectar. This comes in Tantra and in Shastra. The moon itself gives nectar. And of course we know that the moon shines and it gives rasa to all the plants. The juices of the plants flow because of the moon. And the plants have grow because of the influence of the moon. So the moon is associated with nectar also. So therefore it is called the Akila Rasa Amrita Murti. It is also the incarnation of all nectar, the moon itself. And Taraka Pali means literally a string of stars in the sky. So when we look up in the sky, we'll see all these stars in the Milky Way and all these different constellations spread out in the sky. So therefore the moon is with the stars in the sky, but it spreads out its light to embrace all the different stars, to outshine them, and spreads its light around the different stars in the sky. And Shama, of course, means night. So it is, the moon is like carrying out its lila or lalita in the embraced by the night. And Radha refers to a nakshatra, Vishakha nakshatra, or constellation in the sky, which shines very brightly right next to the moon. So therefore this describes the moon in the sky with all the stars around it in general, and in particular with the black sky behind, and then we have the nakshatra Vishakha right next to the moon in a nice between spring and summer. We find this, the nakshatra comes very close. So find that the description of the moon and the stars in the night sky. So that's the secondary image of this verse. So that also is a comparison of Krishna. Krishna is like the moon, and the gopis and all the devotees are like stars in the sky, and all the stars in the sky, Radha is the brightest star, and that combination of Vishakha Nakshatra and this moon is like Krishna and Radha, amidst all the gopis in the sky. So that is the introductory verse, glorifying Krishna's relationship, expressing the rasa. After that, Rupa Goswami glorifies Lord Chaitanya and his older brother, Sanatana Goswami, and then the devotees of the Lord. And the devotees of the Lord he compares to what we may call sharks, makara. Makara actually aren't sharks. Sharks are not very attractive creatures to us. But makara also has, sometimes it means dolphin, which are more, like I say, sattvic. It also refers to one particular big, we can say mythical, not mythical fish, but in the shastras is a special type of huge fish. Which is not actually a fish because it's got an animal head and a fish body kind of thing, you know? And it's floating around the ocean, so it's a big fish, king of the fish, actually. So therefore, when you say makara, it means the best of the fish. why fish? Because fish swim in the ocean, and we're talking about the Rasamrita Sindhu, the Bhakti Rasa ocean. So who is enjoying in the ocean? The great devotees of the Lord, who are like fish who can swim very nicely in the ocean of rasa. So that's their home, of these bhakta makaras, the devotees who are like makaras in the ocean. So they're described as makaras because they are at home playing in the ocean of rasa. And they avoid the nets of time, which means, of course, the sufferings of the material world, time, karma, etc. The makara swim very deeply in the ocean because they're enjoying very nicely the rasa. So they go deep in the ocean. And so the nets will not catch them. The nets are on the surface and they won't catch the makaras. And they avoid the rivers. Rivers flow into the ocean. So Bhakti Rasa Amrita Sindhu is like an ocean, and we get these little side tributaries, the rivers coming into the ocean. These are the rivers of mukti. But the makaras, they don't care for the rivers, these other types of things. They only care for the Bhakti Rasa. They don't care for having same body like the Lord, or same planet, or Sayuja Mukti, any of these things. They care only for that rasa of pleasing Krishna. So they avoid all the rivers of liberation. So he pays his respects to these devotees of the Lord who are simply engaged in enjoying with Krishna and ignoring everything else. So they ignore the material world. They also ignore all types of liberation. So Rupa Goswami glorifies the devotees. And he glorifies the ocean itself, the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, because it defeats the tongues, the sharp tongues of the fiery tongues of the Mimamsakas. Those are the people who propagate karma and jnana, or impersonal philosophy and materialistic philosophies, which are compared to fire in the ocean, or volcanoes in the ocean. There's in the Puranas, there's an image of the ocean, and in the ocean there's these there's a place where there's fire shooting out from underneath. So these are compared to the logicians and the impersonalists and the karmakandis who are criticizing bhakti all the time. But the ocean of bhakti is such that it covers everything else. It defeats all of these fires. The fires cannot survive in the ocean of bhakti. So he pays respect to the ocean, nectarian ocean of devotion, because it defeats all of the fires of the logicians. So then after that, he begins the main book. And he begins with a definition, a general definition of bhakti, which is the very important. And then within this definition, we'll get sub-definitions. A general definition of bhakti is given. The rest of this chapter actually is concerned with bhakti in general. And then the other three chapters are dealing with three types of bhakti, sadhana bhakti, bhava bhakti, and prema bhakti, which all come within this one definition of bhakti. And then within sadhana bhakti, we get two definitions beneath that. But it all comes within the first definition. So the first definition is this Anya Abhilashita Shunya Dhyana Karma Dhyaravratam Anukunya Krishna Nusiranam Bhakti Uttama. So this is the most important definition we should know. Because if we don't know this, then the other definitions are also useless if we know them. Because everything depends on this definition of bhakti. And if we don't know this definition of bhakti, then we don't know what bhakti is. Because this bhakti, which will lead to the gradual stages from Shraddha to Prema. If you practice this bhakti. If you practice other types of bhakti, then you don't get to Prema. So bhakti is called a science, and it has precise definitions. It's like science. You have to define everything. What is an atom? What is a proton? What is a neutron? What is speed? What is mass? Particular definitions. And the definitions don't shift back and forth and cover different things. It covers a certain area. Certain things are included in the definition. Things are excluded. So in bhakti also, the definition will include certain things and will exclude other things. That's what a definition does. So this is where we can be precise about what is bhakti and what is not bhakti by applying this definition. So definitions are very important. So the main, what we call the Swarup Lakshana, the main part of this definition is Anukulyena Krishna Anusilanam. And this is called Uttama Bhakti. Uttama Bhakti, of course, means supreme bhakti or pure bhakti. Or that bhakti which leads to prema. But within this bhakti we have sadhana bhakti, which isn't literally pure because we're going through the process of anartha nivritti, etc. Nevertheless, it's all included in the definition of uttama bhakti, or pure bhakti. So, first of all, anusilanam. Anusilanam means activities. And the activities are directed towards Krishna, Krishna anusilanam. And they're directed towards Krishna favorably, anukulyena, with a favorable attitude. So this is the main definition of devotion. Anusilanam, as I explained, of course, is activity. But activity has two shades of meaning. One is the active, intentional sense, and the other is a more emotional sense, we can say. So therefore, anusilanam can be divided into two categories. This is how Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur divides it into two parts. That is the Chesta Rupa and Bhav Rupa. There's two types of anusilanam or activities. So Chesta Rupa means basically active or with intention we do things involving the body, mind, and words. This is what we're familiar with in devotional service, like hearing and chanting and doing deity worship, etc., cooking, etc. This is just a rupa bhakti. We engage our body, our words, mind, for a particular purpose. So sadhana bhakti basically involves this, just a rupa. But there's another type of activity. For instance, if one goes into bhava and prema, then one may not be doing these activities so visibly anymore. And in bhava and prema, we have a description of other elements like sthayi bhava,
Vyabhachari Bhava and Anubhava, etc. So where do they fall? So under this Bhav-Rupa Bhakti, we get these different symptoms, Sattvika Bhavas, crying, shivering of the body, change of color, choked voice. These are Sattvika Bhavas, symptoms of devotion. These are the elements of rasa, actually, the Sattvika Bhavas, Vyabhachari Bhavas, lamentation, etc. So we've got different things there, the Vyabhachari Bhavas and the Sattvika Bhavas, and Stayi Bhava, relationship with Krishna as parent or as friend, etc. Sakya Bhava or Vatsalya Bhava, Madhurya Bhava, these are Stayi Bhavas. So they're all part of bhakti, and they're anusilanam also. One's very relationship with Krishna is an anusilanam. But it's not like we think anusilanam as, you know, action with the body. But nevertheless, it's included within that. So in Krishna anusilanam, these what we call ecstatic symptoms and the relationship with Krishna, they're also anusilanam. Obviously, it's more internal anusilanam. So that's called bhav-rupa anusilanam. And on the stage of rasa, of course, we get what's called anubhavas. These are also chester rupa, that is, dancing, etc. When we express our joy towards Krishna, we may do activities like singing, dancing, etc. That's on the stage of prema, of course. That's called anubhavas. So those are also chester rupa bhakti, involving the body. But they're coming from a higher level. So this way we have chester rupa bhakti and bhav rupa bhakti. These are part of anusidhanam, or cultivation of bhakti. Some of which are on sadhana bhakti and some of which are on bhava and prema. So in this way, all anusidhanam covers all stages of bhakti, all the activities of all stages, sadhana, bhava and prema. So this is directed towards Krishna. Krishna anusilanam. Vishnu Chakravarti says, of course, that not only Krishna, but to the devotees of Krishna also, because they're related to Krishna. For instance, the first anga of bhakti, a second anga of bhakti is, the first anga is one should approach and surrender to Guru. So that's not Krishna. So is that anga, is it part of bhakti or not? So he said, yes, it is, because it's related to Krishna. The Guru is relating you to Krishna. So this is related to Krishna. So therefore it is Anga Bhakti. So when it's a Krishna Anusidhanam, activities directed towards Krishna or things related to Krishna or people related to Krishna, devotees of Krishna also is included in that term, Krishna. And not only Krishna, but Krishna and other avatar forms also. If one has does activities for Vishnu or for Narasimhadev, it is also considered Uttama Bhakti. So all the forms of God, that is Vishnu forms, avatar forms, Krishna forms, are all included in this definition of Krishna Anusidhanam. But it will exclude those who are not Vishnu Tattva. That is jivas, who are not devotees of the Lord, and Shiva. These will be excluded, not included in the term Krishna. So it's activities directed towards the Supreme Lord of Vishnu Tattva form or Krishna. But not towards Jiva or not towards Shiva or Devata or Brahma, etc. So therefore we have a definition of the activities, we have a definition of who we direct the activities to, and then we have how you direct your activities. Because Kamsa was also directing himself towards Krishna. He was thinking of Krishna day and night. But we don't consider him a devotee. He's not in Uttama Bhakti. So we cannot just say anyone who directs himself towards Krishna is a devotee. No. He was thinking of Krishna. That comes within anusilana, it comes within the definition of relating his thoughts to Krishna. But it was not done with devotion. It was not done favorably. It was not done to please Krishna. So therefore we have to exclude that. So that's why the word anukulina is there. That's favorable. Sometimes you may think that what is pleasing to Krishna is favorable.
But then there's an example to show that sometimes things do not please Krishna, but are also considered favorable. So example is given of Mother Yasoda. When Krishna is hungry, he sits on Mother Yasoda's lap and starts drinking her milk. And then Mother Yasoda hears the fire in the kitchen, and then the milk is burning over and it's sizzling. So she puts Krishna down and runs into the kitchen to take the milk off. And Krishna gets angry. And he kicks the yogurt pot and he breaks it. And he smears the yogurt around with his feet and he runs away. And so Krishna gets angry at Mother Yasoda for going to the kitchen. So then we can say that therefore this is not devotional service on the part of Mother Yasoda because it made Krishna angry. But we know that Mother Yasoda is a pure devotee of the Lord and all of her activities are pure devotion. So therefore we cannot say that she is not doing devotional service. Even if Krishna becomes angry, it's still devotional service. So therefore we cannot say that anukuliyena means that that's which is pleasing to Krishna. Means that Krishna is not pleased. Still devotion. So therefore a better definition would be that that which has an intention on our part of pleasing Krishna, that is anukuliyena. Because Mother Yasoda has an intention of pleasing Krishna by taking the milk off the fire, because she wants to offer the milk to Krishna. And Krishna may become angry, but her intention is to please Krishna by her act. So in this way, we can say that which is done with an intention of trying to please Krishna, that is anukuliyena. And, of course, if we say pleasing to Krishna, sometimes Krishna will also be pleased with an activity, though it is not devotional service. For instance, Krishna is very pleased to fight with the demons. Krishna, as Narasimha Deva, is very happy to fight with Hiranyakasipu. He's very pleased with that. But it's not devotional service on the part of Hiranyakasipu at all. It's pleasing to Krishna, definitely. But it is not devotional service. So that's another instance of something which is pleasing to Krishna, but it's not devotional service. And we get something which is unpleasing to Krishna, which is devotional service. So therefore, the best definition is that which is done with an intention of pleasing the Supreme Lord. That is anukuliyena, or favorable. So that covers the last line of that verse. That's the sarup lakshana, the main clause of the verse. And then that is qualified by anya abhilasha shunya and jnana karma janavartam, not covered by jnana karma and devoid of anya abhilasha or other desires. Devoid of other desires. Sunya means devoid. Anya abhilas means other desires. So devoid of other desires. Only to please the Supreme Lord. That's our intention. No other desires. In other words, we do not have desires for ourselves. Or desire to please somebody else. Only desire to please Krishna. No other desires are there. There's an explanation, of course, why Rupa Goswami does not say anya abhilasha shunya. That means devoid of other desires. But he said anya abhilasha ta shunya. So when he says anya abhilasha ta, it means devoid in general of the other desires. So the explanation is that sometimes a real devotee of the Lord, if he's in a dangerous position, he may cry to Krishna and say, protect me. So then we can say he's not a devotee anymore because he's asking for his own protection from Krishna. But then the acharyas say, no, it is natural for the devotee to depend on Krishna than to depend on people of this material world or devatas or whatever.
So therefore, that is not an obstacle to his devotion. So therefore, only in general we can say there's no, as anya, as devoid of other desires. But if one has a desire for protection from Krishna in a difficult circumstance, it's acceptable. So in general, it's devoid of other desires. But in particular cases, it's acceptable to have those desires. So it's natural that the devotee surrenders to the Lord and takes him as his only protector. So if we pray for Krishna's protection in this difficult circumstance, that does not exclude us from this definition of Uttama Bhakti. So therefore he uses the word anya abhilashita sunya. And then the other phrase is jnana, karma, adi, anavritam, not covered by jnana, karma, etc. So jnana, of course, refers to impersonal knowledge. And karma refers, of course, to material activities for material benefit. And it is not covered by these things. So some types of jnana will cover bhakti, or oppose bhakti, or obstruct bhakti. And some types of karma will, some types of activities will obstruct bhakti. So the impersonal jnana, that is what will obstruct bhakti. And the materialistic karma, that will obstruct bhakti. But he does not say karma jnana sunya. He just says that shouldn't be an obstacle. And why he says that is because some types of knowledge are favorable to bhakti and necessary for bhakti. We need knowledge to advance in devotional service. We need Bhagavad jnana, Sambandha jnana. If we don't have these things, we can't advance. We need knowledge of the definition of bhakti. Otherwise, we cannot perform bhakti. So knowledge about the Lord, about devotional service, the philosophy, Sambandha jnana, we need these things for advancement in devotional service. They do not cover bhakti. So therefore, we cultivate that type of knowledge. And those types of knowledge which are unfavorable, that is impersonal jnana and things like that, that we avoid. And karma, of course, we avoid materialistic karma. We do not deny all karma. We do devotional activities using the body, the mind, and the words, etc. These are activities. Anusilana is an activity also. As the Chester Rupa side, and then we have the Bhava Rupa side. But Chester Rupa means activities. So we don't avoid activities. We also do activities of bhakti. But we don't do the materialistic activities. Which keep us in the material world. And even a devotee may, for in particular purposes, perform rituals which may be within karmakanda or whatever, but if they're not contradictory to bhakti, and one can do them just to set an example for other people, but if he's unattached to the results, he's not doing it for his own purpose, then just to follow the tradition or whatever, and not set a bad example for the common people, he may do these things without attachment, and therefore he cannot be criticized for that. Because it's nothing to do with his bhakti, he's not attached to the results there. And of course, adi refers to yoga and logic and renunciation, all other things. If they cover devotional service or obstruct, then of course we don't do them. So this is the important definition of bhakti. And it's the basis for all the other definitions and all the other activities of bhakti. What? Which one? Anyabhilashadashanya. It's within the first, in that introduction, I think, isn't it? It's supposed to be in there somewhere. Theoretically, it should be in the first chapter, but actually it's in the introduction, because the introduction, kind of part of the first chapter is in the introduction and gets cut. And then into the first chapter, kind of cuts off arbitrarily, I think in the middle of the, somewhere in the middle. So, any questions there?
Uncle.
Intention of pleasing Krishna.
Yeah.
But often if that is done in an unauthorized way, I was thinking of Napa Sampradayas.
Oh, we think it's pleasing to the Lord, but actually may not be? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Is it bhakti or not? We don't know. It is pleasing. We have an intention of pleasing the Lord. Yeah, that's good to have a good intention. But then, usually, if one is a little intelligent, and we are trying to please the Lord, then we will try to understand what is pleasing to the Lord, rather than things. So then we'll learn something about that. In other words, even in the material world, for instance, if you want to please somebody by an activity, then you won't just offer them anything. You'll find out what they like. And then you offer those things to them.
Huh? So, is that a definition of a relative definition, or is it an absolute one?
How do you mean relative?
Well, it's relative. Say, 15 years ago, I might have tried to offer some biscuits to the Lord.
Oh, I see.
And they had eggs in.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe at that time, it might be acceptable.
Well, I guess relative to your knowledge, we can say, like that. So, like, devotion is the devotional element is important. And if we're ignorant, we do things which maybe we would consider offensive or something. It's not our ignorance, but the devotional element is strong. Then we can say that's acceptable. It's good for you. But then, of course, if you get knowledge, then you should prevent those things or give those things up and do other things.
So, it seems like it's a dynamic.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. The more pure you become, then the more refined your intentions become. Yeah. And the more it's pleasing to Krishna.
This definition would seem could only apply to within the Vedic culture. Like non-Vedic religious paths can come under this.
Oh, pleasing to Krishna.
Well, it seems like at least Vaishnava culture, like within the Vedic culture, is the guidelines are always instructing us to be free from, you know, fruit of desires, aspirations,
such as
the non-Vedic sort of paths.
Mm-hmm.
That seemed to encompass, at least today, maybe in the original, you know, it was much more pure, but, you know, Christianity, Islam, etc.
Mm-hmm. How would it apply, you mean?
Well,
or does it apply at all?
The definition would seem that it doesn't apply outside the Vedic.
Oh, because it's referring to certain specifics in terms of Vedic culture. Well, we'll get the reflections of that, I think, even if we don't have Karmakanda and Gyankanda in the Western world. We do definitely have a reflection of that in terms of materialistic motives mixed with religion or desire for impersonal liberation within the religion also, which is quite prominent, let's say. In other words, we just want to get out of the material world, that type of thing. So we do have that type of, you know, attitude there also mixed with different religions. So it's not called jnana and karma, etc.
So could we say karma misra bhakti is like these other religious traditions?
Yeah, karma, misra, bhakti, or jnana, misra, bhakti. We see that all of these religions, basically, there is that little bit of materialism mixed with it. I want peace, I want prosperity kind of thing. You know, in fact, a lot of the concept of perfection is going to heaven where you get all your material comfort satisfied. It's a little bit of a kind of a contradiction there. On one hand, they're talking about pure love, but on the other hand, they're trying to get all the material needs satisfied. So it's not very clearly defined, you can say.
So we could say you can achieve pure bhakti within those particular...
Yeah. Of course, we do find, like, Christ, when he teaches, he seems to be talking about pure love, because he does say that, you know, if you want to... the person who's a wealthy man... It's very difficult for him to attain God. It's harder than to pass a camel through the eye of a needle than for a wealthy man to go to God, because he's attached to material things. Yeah? And if you want to come, if you want to follow me, then you have to give up all these things. So his teachings is quite, we can see there's an element of purity there.
And he says, you cannot love your mother, cannot love your father, cannot love your children. Only love me. Only love God. So there he's pointing to some sort of exclusive devotion to the Lord.
You gave an example about Mother Yasoda and picking the body and all that. So if let's say for us, we are practicing devotee, and if let's say we come to a situation where we obviously we try to be no motivation, but we say something that might hurt someone, but how do we know whether what we say is pleasing to Krishna or not pleasing to Krishna? So, like incident, like we see that someone might be doing an activity or saying something that is not in accordance to the scripture or whatsoever, and we try to change, we try to correct or whatsoever, how do we, whether we are pleasing Krishna in that way or not?
Well, I think the main thing is our intentions. If our intentions are based upon trying to please Krishna and not trying to do something for ourselves, then it's acceptable even if the effects may, because we're not completely in knowledge, maybe something happens and we may get a bad result from whatever, as long as our intention is pure, that we're trying to please Krishna, then there's no harm in our part. And by experience, then we can learn what to do and what not to do in terms of the material world. Krishna at the end of the Bhagavad Gita says, give up all dharmas and simply surrender unto me, and I will deliver you from all sinful reactions, all problems like this. So just don't worry. You simply attempt to surrender unto me. Whatever mistakes are there, whatever happens, whatever, if that attempt of surrender is there, that's higher than everything else. So all the other mistakes, the things get nullified. The reactions get nullified. As long as the intention is pure.
Some of the other cultivation systems that have recently popped up, for instance, in China, Falun Gong, where do they stand?
The Falun Gong seems to be mainly into mystic powers, as far as I can see. A lot of it's...
Because they propound that they teach to reject matter or to detachment, but they seem to be heading somewhere not in the material sphere, but yet not spiritual.
I think in the subtle material spheres. Because they talk about other worlds and things like this, mystic powers, etc., more like yoga, and subtle material worlds or heavenly planets and things like this. Which is part of the Adi, the yoga and siddhis and things like that. It would cover up pure bhakti.
Is that a place? Does that have a place for people who want to progress on the yoga ladder?
What is that?
To cultivate that kind of system for people?
Is that favorable for bhakti or
not? No, it's got a place. On the rung of the yoga ladder.
Oh, the yoga.
Yes.
Yoga system. Well, if it's done properly, then it leads to paramatma realization. If one does it properly. But then, if one does it properly, one has to avoid the cities, avoid indulging in those powers. Otherwise, one gets caught in those things and one ends up in the material world. And if one does properly, then one will get paramatma realization, which is basically shantarasa. Well, they can also by bad association. They can realize Paramatma and merge into Paramatma, merge into the effulgence of Paramatma also. And as they get association of devotees, then they can advance from Shanta Rasa up higher to some more positive Rasa.
People that are doing channeling,
different
entities.
Mm-hmm.
Where
are
those
entities
coming from?
Well, just above us, it's described in the Bhagavatam that we're on Bhuloka, and above us is Bhuvarloka. Right next to us, it's right next level. Bhuvarloka is not actually like Svarga. Svarga is like Sattvic. But Bhuvarloka contains all sorts of mixed entities like ghosts, Rakshasas, Yakshas, Gandharvas, and other beings. Has a big long list of names given in Bhagavatam. So it's a mixture of all sorts of entities in that level.
they're considered higher than us because they have more subtle bodies and more powers than us, but not necessarily pure. So then we get all sorts of entities, tamogun and rajagun, mixed entities. And they have powers, and they can talk to you and do social things, influence the mind and like that. So some of the entities may come from there. Others could be higher, devatas also, or other levels also. Depends. Well, that's basically pranic energy. That's energy. Okay, anything else there? Next thing is that in this first chapter, first part, Rupa Goswami mentions six qualities of bhakti. Two of which manifest in sadhana bhakti, the next two in bhava bhakti, and the last two in prema bhakti. So the first is klesha agni, and the second is subhada. Klesha, of course, means suffering. Agni means, comes from han. Han means to kill or destroy. So klesha agni means to destroy suffering. And subhada means bestowal of subha or auspiciousness. And so these two qualities start to manifest in sadhana bhakti itself. And they'll also be in bhava bhakti and prema bhakti. Only when one gets to bhava bhakti, the second two qualities manifest. And when one gets to prema bhakti, the last two qualities manifest. So the first one is called klesha agni, or destruction of suffering. So, suffering is of three types: papa, bija, and avidya. Papa refers to the reactions we get from our sinful activities. That is, accident, sickness, losing money, whatever. All sorts of things. This is all reactions to sinful activities. So that's papa. Bijam refers to the desire. We have a desire to enjoy in a certain way. Therefore, we do an activity. And that activity may be papa punya, and that gives us a result in terms of klesha. So the klesha covers the action, its result, and its cause, the desire, or bija. And more subtle than the bija or the desire is avidya, ignorance. That's the most subtle cause. In avidya, that ignorance is ignorance of Krishna. Basically, we don't accept God, and instead we enjoy. We try to put ourselves in the center of enjoyment. And so this is the first cause, the origin of all of our sufferings in this material world. And so that rejection of Krishna and desire to enjoy for ourselves leads to all these bijas, desires. And then this leads to action. Action leads to suffering. So klesha agni means these are all wiped out, destroyed by the process of bhakti. The karma is destroyed. The action is destroyed. The bija is destroyed. The desire is destroyed. And the ignorance is destroyed. So from the subtle to the most gross effects, we get destruction taking place. That's klesha agni. And then Rupa Goswami divides up the papa, or the sin, into two types: prarabdha and aprarabdha. Prarabdha means those that you have to experience now, and aprarabdha means those that you don't experience now, not in this lifetime. In other words, we do many, many sinful activities in the past, and some of them we'll experience now, and some are still waiting for future lives. We've done the activity in the past. We're getting a reaction, but it's not manifest now. It'll manifest next lifetime or next life or next lifetime. Those are aprarabdha karmas. We don't even know about them. But they'll manifest in the future. Even if we don't do any more activities now, we'll still have to get bodies to experience those aparabdha karmas caused by previous actions. So therefore our kleshas are two types, the unmanifest and the manifest. The ones that are going to manifest now in this lifetime are the aparabdha karmas. And that is furthermore divided up again into divisions. Aparabdha, Kuta, Bija, and Phalamukha. Four, in other words, it's four divisions. And we, from the two, Aparabdha and Parabdha, we get Aparabdha, Kuta, Bija, and Phalamukha or Parabdha. We get a gradation of sinful reaction from the unexperienced to the experienced in four stages. Huh? And all of these are destroyed again by bhakti. So in this way, in this lifetime, we have what we experience now, and then we have which are completely unexperienced and will not experience in this lifetime at all, and then we get some karmas which gradually begin to manifest, slight traces of manifestation from subtle to gross. So that's the Kuta and the Bija stage. Kuta, Bija, and then follow Mokha, or we experience. On the Bija stage, basically, we'll have a slight detection that's coming, maybe in dream or something. Get some mental image of what's going to happen, and suddenly, and when it happens, that's the Parabdha Karma. So we get from the subtle to the gross. And four stages taking place. So then finally what we get is we get avidya, and then we get desires, or bija, then we get papa, and then we get aparabdha, kuta, bija, prabdha. And that's one word for that. This is prabdha, that's the suffering we get now. So all of these stages are wiped out by the process of bhakti. The process of karma kanda, they will do prayasitta. And by prayasitta, you can reduce the effects of your karmas a little bit. But what is the problem with karma? Why is it criticized in Bhagavatam?
It's the seed of the desire.
Yeah. The desire is still there. It doesn't. The prayasitta does not wipe out the desire. So then again you commit the same sinful activity, again you have to suffer. So it's not a solution. So karma kanda, prayaschitta, is not a solution to our problem. It doesn't get to the root. It just wipes out the effects. Nijan, of course, eventually, after much control of the senses and renunciation, etc., we get rid of our karmas, and one can get liberation. So one can reduce all the one's karmas to zero. It's there. But it takes, it's very, very difficult to do. It takes a long time to do. So one can wipe out one's karmas or one's kleshas through the process of jnana. However, in the process of jnana, they do never claim that they can wipe out your parabdha karmas. You have to simply suffer what is due in this lifetime, even with your jnana. And once you've endured your parabdha karmas and you've got rid of all of your aparabdha karmas, then you get liberated. But it does not claim to wipe out the parabdha karmas either. And once you practice again, you wipe out your karmas, but the soul actually doesn't develop. We simply separate the soul from the material and the gross body and the subtle body. That is liberation and personal liberation. But the soul itself does not develop devotion. So therefore it doesn't attach itself to Krishna. So the process of bhakti wipes out the effects, the parabdha karmas and the aparabdha karmas and the desire and the avidya, and it establishes our relationship with Krishna. So the soul develops its surupa in relation to Krishna. And that is not done by jnana and personal thought and devotion and personal liberation. So the process of bhakti is the most effective way of wiping out all of the
all stages of karma and bondage. Plus, not only does that, but it establishes our self in relation to Krishna. So the process itself is a little different from jnana. Jnana is the process of wiping out our material connection. Bhakti is the process of establishing our spiritual connection. And in the process, the material connection gets wiped out. In other words, when we establish ourselves with Krishna 100%, then there's 0% for the material world. If we're 100% attached to Krishna, we have zero attachment to the material world. The process of bhakti is basically not a negative process of rejecting the material world, but rather the positive process of attaching yourself to Krishna. And as a secondary result, the material connection disappears. So in the process of bhakti, we actually start at the top and go backwards. In other words, we're wiping out the avidya by recognizing and surrendering to Krishna. And when we wipe out the seed of all the karmas, and everything else, the root of all karmas is destroyed, then everything else also is destroyed. If we wipe out avidya, then the bija and the papa and the aparabdha and the prabdha all disappear. So this is why the bhakti process is so effective, because it gets to the very root of the problem. So, talking about was Prabhupada and Aparabdha. Sometimes you will get effects right immediately also in this lifetime. Usually we don't call those karmas as such, but some things you do foolishly in this lifetime, you get immediate results from that also. And particularly in devotional service. Here we're talking about karmas, papa and punya. In devotional service, we can get immediate results for our activities also. And even in the material world, you get immediate results. If you drive your car the wrong way, you get in an accident. Immediate karma, so to speak. We don't usually call that a karma. We just call it foolishness or inattention. So many things we can do in this material world which we get immediate reactions for. In terms of reaction, of course, we do a sinful activity now. One can get a result in this lifetime. If you steal something and if they catch you, you get put in jail. That's an immediate reaction. Similarly, you can do, as a devotee also, you can do sinful things, and you can also get the immediate reaction to that. Well, no, it'll happen eventually, because the laws of the Lord are inevitable. We cannot escape them. Because it's only that for some reason, there's a delay. It could be because one has many punyas behind one. And one has to enjoy the punyas first. Then after that, then we'll get the reaction. There could be many reasons for this.
Within devotional services, in Vaishchitta, it seems like bathing in Ganges, Sukhanam, Yuridhi, Tulsi, that actually promised devotees.
Some sort of price, it's also, yeah. Of course, bhakti activities act on both levels. They're the best of punyas, plus they also have the spiritual aspect to them. And even Rupa Goswami says, and when he quotes from each type of bhakti, then he gives some quotes from Puranas. He says, well, some of these quotations look a little fruitive, and they're promising material results for your devotional activity. They get so many, destruction of karmas, or you get kingdom and swarga, or whatever. Well, this is a secondary effect of the devotional activity. The primary effect, of course, is it increases our devotion to Krishna. Secondarily, does this. But to encourage the people on a lower level, it magnifies the material results that we may get also. Anyway, all the devotional activities have two levels, two results. That is the punya result, which we'll give, plus the spiritual result. So both things are there.
Sometimes it's said when one becomes a devotee, they're not creating any more karma.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Krishna personally takes charge of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So any reactions you may get, can we understand that they're simply coming from previous activities, or is it that somehow or other some type of karma is there, or that Krishna mm-hmm. personally
yeah.
manifests?
Yeah, why do we get reactions, or what appear to be reactions even now when we're in devotional service? Well, one thing, of course, is that it's not that immediately all your karmas are destroyed. Your paramitas and aparamita karmas are not immediately all destroyed. Mm-hmm. It's just kramena praliyate, gradually, or step by step, they're destroyed. Huh? So in the process of an arjuna vritti, there's a gradual decrease in nishtha and ruchi like that. And gradually, all of your karmas get destroyed in that process. And until bhava. And prema, zero karmas. Bhava, the little trace of something is there. So it's a gradual process of elimination of the effects of karmas. Not a sudden thing. So therefore, if we're getting effects, it's the partial effect, let's say, of our karmas operating.
So when we take diksha, said that the guru takes the karma, what the karma we're
yeah.
talking about?
Well, my understanding, because this is the bhakti reduces the karma, so in the sense that the guru teaches bhakti and you perform bhakti, then you can get rid of your karmas that way. Of course, in another sense, because the guru takes responsibility for the disciple, he has to share karmas. But to my understanding, that means from that point onwards, after the diksha, he's responsible for the student, and the student commits a sin, then he's also responsible. He has to take some share, not the whole thing, but obviously some share of the results of his bad activity, because he made a vow at that point, from now on you act like this, and he promises.
So it's not that the guru is taking your previous...
To me it doesn't seem so, because then what is the process of anarjana vritti?
Mm-hmm.
The process of bhakti itself is purifying us of our previous karmas.
Mm-hmm.
In the story, you say that for 7 years one has to suffer, from the age of this 40 to 15, you have to go through for 7 years everything. You will be suffering, you will be suffering. Anything happens to the devotees also, they have to suffer for that period. The star of such life that you have to suffer for that period.
Oh, what was that? Sarasati?
In the story, you say for 7 years you have to suffer.
Sarasati.
The time comes. Oh,
we have to suffer. Well, as I said, for the devotee, the karmas are gradually reduced. If one is a pure devotee, of course, there's no suffering at all. There's no karma at all. And therefore, the predictions probably won't be so true. For one who's less advanced, of course, then there's a partial effect of those karmas. Huh? But the Bhagavatam says, in any case, the devotee should understand that all the suffering is his own fault. It's not Krishna's fault. He has done activities in the past which are creating his suffering now. And therefore, it's his duty to accept it and correct his attitude, and to continue his devotional service. Then he becomes the rightful recipient of Krishna's mercy by that. And so he should tolerate, accept, and continue devotional service.
Now, that's how we understand, say, there's a devotee who's been practicing it for years, and seemingly something happens that is a normal person would see as distressful. But because that devotee is elevated, even though that experience seems to be a bad experience, but the devotee, because he is realized, he doesn't suffer that.
Mm.
He is beyond these things.
Yeah.
So that might have appeared though he's suffering, but actually because of his state of realization, he doesn't suffer. So is that what it means?
Well, both things. One is that the karmas themselves are reduced, and the other are destroyed, and the other is that his attitude is such that he doesn't suffer in the, even if the circumstance is there. Both things are there. Huh? But one should never consider that the pure devotee of the Lord who is devoid of karmas is suffering for karma. Huh? Just like Krishna, some people will say, oh, he got cursed by the hunter or this happened. Nothing happened. Krishna cannot be cursed by anybody ultimately. And so the pure devotee of the Lord, also like the Pandavas, they're suffering in the forest for 13 years, then they're not under karma also. If it is appearance of suffering, it is the will of the Lord only.
So it is not karma. Devotee's reaction to the situation, one can engage how he or she is.
Generally, the devotee is not concerned with the material world at all. So in happiness or distress or heaven or hell, he doesn't really care anyway.
Shall we do one more? Okay, the next quality is Subhada, or bestowal of auspiciousness. So auspiciousness, this is like a positive aspect. The other was a negative. Destroy the bad things. And then the bestowal of good things. Subha. So there are several definitions of Subha. Four definitions to be exact. One is that the devotee himself becomes compassionate to all living entities. He shows compassion, develops compassion to the whole universe or the whole world. The second is that the whole world becomes attracted to the devotee and respects the devotee. All living entities respect the devotee. Their definition is that he has shadguna, he develops shadguna, or all good qualities. And Rupa Goswami calls from Bhagavatam that the devotee develops all the qualities of the devata, that's accepted like that. So any good quality in the material world becomes manifest in the devotee. Why is that? Because Krishna himself is full of all wonderful qualities and perfection. And the jiva is his amsa, so he has these qualities in part. And if one performs devotional service, then the natural qualities begin to manifest from the soul. They're not imposed by society or anything. They come from the soul. So by the process of bhakti, these things begin to manifest naturally. And so that's the manifestation of good qualities. The last definition of Subha is the happiness. So Rupa Goswami says there's three types of happiness. Happiness from materialism, bhoga. Happiness from liberation. And happiness from bhakti. Bhakti sukha. So one can, in devotional service, of course, through devotional service, one can get all three of them. But generally the devotees are not interested in the bhoga, material enjoyment, and they reject the happiness of liberation also. But they get satisfaction from the performance of bhakti, spiritual satisfaction. So that is the fourth type of subha. So this is not, of course, the same as prema. Prema is a full manifestation of our love of Krishna. But even in sadhana bhakti, we get some spiritual satisfaction. So this is a sukha that comes in subhada. So Vishnu Chakravarti in this Madhura Kanamani says the plant of bhakti grows up like a little seed, and then it manifests two little leaves. So these two little leaves that bhakti first manifests are subhada and kreshagni. These two little leaves come out first in the process of bhakti, in sadhana bhakti itself. So these are the first two qualities that manifest. And in sadhana bhakti, they should begin to appear. So one is doing sadhana, and then one should get a reduction of suffering. And one should get some nice qualities appearing. So if neither effect is there, it means the process is not done properly. There's some opposite qualities begin to appear, then we know that the process is not done properly, it's not executed properly. What's that?
What was the second quality, the two names? What was the second name?
Subhada.
The second one?
That was the second one. Kreshagni. Kreshagni, Subhada. Okay, I think we should probably stop there. Any other questions?
It's been observed by some devotees, at least in this form anyway, that the biggest obstacle devotees seem to come across in their progression is going through the stage of anatta nivritti.
Mm-hmm.
That seems to be makes or breaks devotees. Mm. The first few stages one may progress reasonably quickly, but that seems to be the real sort of test to be able to overcome that. Would you agree with that in your observation?
Well, anatta nivritti is a gradual stage. What happens there, in most cases, is probably aparad, and this is what blocks it. The stage itself should go smoothly if it is done properly.
Mm-hmm.
Just like you study in school and you attend the classes and you go through the courses.
Yeah.
Okay, so, provided one has some innate abilities, which we call faith. If the faith is there, and go through it fine. If the faith is not there actually in the beginning, the genuine faith is not, then the process won't go properly. Because Shraddha is the first step. Now, Shraddha is not there, then the other things will not follow. It won't be real bhakti. But if real Shraddha is there in the beginning, real intention of giving up self-interest and surrendering to the Lord, that is there, and one performs properly, then it should go smoothly. Huh? Except in the case of aparad.
Mm-hmm.
If we commit offense, then this will block the progress on any particular stage.
What are the symptoms of one who is practicing to be in Krishna conscious, right? After practicing a while, what sort of symptoms manifest within a devotee?
Uh-huh.
Should they be quiet, be happy, be humble, or whatever?
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, these are the first two qualities. Klesha Agni, suffering should reduce.
Uh-huh.
Huh? And, that, of course, within that is avidya, desires, and sinful activities, and the kleshas, the results of our sinful activities, should also minimize. And secondly, one should have a manifestation of compassion and attractive all living entities and manifestation of good qualities, such as gentleness and truthfulness, and all the good qualities. And then this bhakti sukha. He'll develop some sense of happiness from doing his devotional service. Huh?
Is it within? Happiness is within? Or
yeah.
Within.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm going to end here now. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Thank you.